when you're writing the notes and your theme is very much in your mind, you think that something sounds very simple, and when you come back several months later and read it again, you think, well, I don't think that sounds all that simple, so I put it onto a transparency to try and make it sound a bit simpler. So you start writing like fury there at the moment, and I'll try and keep talking long enough so that you've got time to write it down. Yes. The reference to the silver trumpets was considered in quite some length back in volume one of the notes, so I didn't go through that aspect again, but right back in Revelation chapter 1 we had the voice as of a trumpet, and then in Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1 that same trumpet voice came again. There were the two soundings of the trumpet answering to the soundings of those silver trumpets which you mentioned. So yes, thanks for bringing that point up again, Arthur. But you, those who've been following the class right from the beginning will remember that we have had references to trumpets before. But on this occasion I just summarised the judgmental aspect of it, which I think is what is particularly coming out here in Revelation chapter 8. Now, I have had comments from people who are our tape audience that they can't of course see what's on the transparency, so we would ask that those who are taking tapes for people be so kind as to take a copy of this down, because they find it very difficult of course to see this when they haven't got it in front of them. So I will of course read out what is on the transparency, that helps a little bit. Now, our note here tells us that at the commencement of chapter 7 mention was made of four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that no wind should blow upon the earth or the sea or on any tree. All right, we've already commented on that. This holding back was for the purpose of affording opportunity for the process of sealing the servants of God. There is no specific mention of the winds being loosed after this, and therefore it seems that the judgments declared by the first four trumpet sounding angels are in fact the blowing of the four winds. Brother Thomas accordingly speaks of the first four trumpets as wind trumpets, while the remaining three that make up the seven he similarly identifies with the woe, woe, woe of chapter 8 and verse 13. And we know that because the first woe is referred to in chapter 9 verse 12, and the second and the third woe is referred to in chapter 11 and verse 14. Now that really covers this introductory section. So we're about halfway. Those who want to turn their tapes over can. If anyone wants to ask a question on anything we've done up to this stage, just quickly during the changeover we can take it, and it will allow a little bit more time for those who are or should be copying down the note completed. Want to ask a question while we're just letting that rest of that note be copied? I'm sure you've got a question, Arthur. The best idea is to get out a concordance, and you can have a very, very enjoyable time just taking a word like trumpet and seeing all the places where it occurs and the different ways in which it occurs. You'll come to the New Testament and you'll read about the resurrection is heralded in by the angel who comes with the trumpet of God, voice of the archangel. And this is the way that you build up a definition. You see, this definition we've got up at the top here only comes from looking up the references where the word occurs, and we thereby get our own definition. I think there's a lot of people feel that there are certain types of human beings, like study leaders, who have some sort of particular insight that can find out that a trumpet represents something which would summon people together. But they only do it by looking up all the places where the word occurs and finding that they all seem to say the same sort of thing and say, well, that's what it must mean. And you get much more enjoyment, of course, out of doing this yourself than out of... just listening to me. and copying it down. I meant the voice of the Lamb. Yes, that in fact was a statement which was paraphrased direct from Eureka, the voice of the Lamb. I know it says voices there, which makes one feel first up that, you know, it must be a multitude of voices. Well, it is in fact, isn't it? You see, it is the Lamb that's opening the seals. It's the Lamb that's announcing all of these things in the first sense. But the actual way by which the judgment is poured out is not by the Lamb personally, but he performs it through his messengers, whoever the particular angels or messengers may be on a given occasion. It might be the hordes out of the north, it might be the Mohammedans, it might be something else. So when we say that the voices there represent the voice of the Lamb, that is the Lamb as the first cause of it. It's a bit like saying that the armies of Rome, when they came against Jerusalem in AD 70, were the armies of Messiah the Prince, as Daniel says. So that you could say it was Messiah the Prince that destroyed the city of Jerusalem in AD 70. On the basis of what the Bible says. But it wasn't Messiah that did it, it was the armies of Rome. So what Brother Thomas would mean was that it was the voice of the Lamb that figuratively issued the decree, but the ones, of course, who carried it out were these various other parties involved in the administration. So it comes back to this idea of manifestation again. If we try to tie things down too particularly to, you know, who is doing this and who is being spoken of here, we lose the concept. And I feel that this is one thing Brother Thomas never did. He never lost sight of the fact that it was always manifestational. So that's why he could say that it was the voice of the Lamb, and yet in fact, as far as Revelation is concerned, it depicts it as being the voices of multitudes who are throwing the whole place into a turmoil. But it's really the Lamb that is instigating all of this as far as God is concerned. All right, well, we're going to move on now then to looking at the work of these seven angels. But even before the first angel sounds, we find in verse 6 that there was still another preparatory work, because verse 6 of Revelation chapter 8 says, "And the seven angels having the seven trumpets prepared themselves that they might sound." That's Brother Thomas's translation of it. The Authorized Version says, "And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound." But you can see here that there is the suggestion of a preparation which was necessary, even more intensely in Brother Thomas's translation than in the AV. And this preparation was quite interesting. If you read the note here on page 89, in conjunction with the map on page 90, although the map on page 90 is not the best map as far as this particular note is concerned. That map is more associated with some of the things to come. But if you have a look at a map at home which has got things like the River Danube and things like that clearly shown on it, you'll find it perhaps a little easier to follow. So our note tells us that there was a certain preparation which was necessary, because each of these trumpets which were going to sound were going to bring invaders upon some part of the Roman Empire. But there was also a providential period of preparation for these judgment events, which opened up the way for the invading barbarians who occupied the northern parts of Europe. The way had to be paved for their incursion and for their ultimate triumph over the military discipline of Rome. This is implied in the statement, "prepared themselves that they might sound." Brother Roberts describes this period in this way. This is taken from 13 lectures. He says, "This occurred during the reign of one Jovian, who was the successor to our friend Julian that we've just been talking about, who came first after Constantine. The Roman Empire was confined to the south of the River Danube. The territory to the north of that river was as little known to the Romans then as Central Africa is to us." Of course, he's writing around the 1800s. the most that was known was that it was occupied by fierce and warlike tribes whose barbarism and want of discipline, however, rendered them somewhat harmless. If you look at that map down the bottom there and you want to know where the River Danube is, you see that dot dash line that goes across through the middle of Europe there? Well, essentially that's the River Danube. That was the boundary or the border of the empire. So whilst the river isn't exactly shown there, that was the River Danube. So he's talking about the area above the River Danube. Now he says up there was a lot of these warlike tribes whose barbarism and lack of discipline rendered them somewhat harmless. From these causes, they were for centuries easily kept at bay. But a change came when the time arrived to prepare for these judicial trumpets. This change occurred in its most marked form during the reign of Jovian, just before the commencement of the trumpets. It originated in the struggle that took place between two of the barbarian races known as the Goths and the Huns. So here were the Goths and the Huns on the north of the River Danube. And for years and years people had said, don't worry about them, they're quite harmless. But providentially something had to happen if these harmless tribes were going to become harmful to Catholic Rome. In this struggle between the Goths and the Huns obtained the advantage. And the Goths, being hard pressed, asked permission of the Roman generals if they might cross over to the southern side of the Danube to escape from the molestations of their successful enemies. Well, the Roman generals thought, you know, they're pretty harmless, let them come over. So the Roman generals consented, and the Gothic nation came over and settled in the area of Illyricum. Now, Illyricum isn't on that map, but can you see there place called Aquileia? About 3/4 of an inch above Rome. See that there? Well, if you just take that place Aquileia and you just come down the coast there, that area was Illyricum, just below Aquileia, where that black line goes down and merges into the next arrow. Well, don't go down as far as the next arrow, just go down to where that other one ends, and that was the area which was known as Illyricum. So they came down over the border, you see, and they settled in that area of Illyricum. The Romans no longer, therefore, had the Danube as a barrier between them and the barbarians. The barbarians were in their midst, so to speak. The Goths grew numerous and formidable. To avert the danger of their presence, the Romans decided to take them into their pay as military auxiliaries. They gave them arms and money, and they taught them the art of war, and they used them as an addition to the Roman army. The measure, which was intended to make them harmless and allies, had the opposite effect. It converted them into a formidable foe. The Goths gradually woke to a sense of their power, and as the hour was approaching for the blast of the first trumpet, the Goths were getting into position for the work they had to do in obedience to its summons. So those, I think, are the interesting and the significant historical facets to the beginning of these seven trumpets. Right, what have we seen then so far in Revelation chapter 8? We've left off at the time when Constantine changed pagan Rome to Christian Rome. Constantine reigned for between 14 and 15 years, during which time there was peace, there was silence in the heavens. When Constantine died, the empire was divided up amongst his sons, and there were voices and thunders and lightnings and finally an earthquake. And the earthquake came when Julian stood up, the apostate, and said, I'm going to put paganism back. So he supported the Jews, he supported the pagan clergy, and he opposed all forms of Christian religion. He lasted for a year and 8 months, and finally he was deposed and the status quo was reinstated. But the trumpets weren't quite ready to blow because the Goths and the Huns and the other nations were not quite in position to judge now Catholic Rome. So the angels prepared themselves to sound. And the preparation involved this decision by Jovian, who followed Julian, that the Goths might come over and settle on the southern side of the Danube, and they settled in Illyricum, and from there they were now ready to pour out the judgments described principally in the first four wind trumpets. So that brings us then to this section of Revelation chapter 8, which goes from verse 7, the sounding of the first angel, through the sounding of the second angel in verse 8, the third angel in verse 10, and the fourth angel in verse 12. And that concludes the chapter in verse 13. And then in chapter 9 we go on to the fifth angel, which is the first of the woe trumpets. So in these first four angels, and you may like to look now briefly at the chart to see what it's going to talk about in a general sense, we're going to have four different aspects of the judgment which would be poured out upon Catholic Rome. Each one of it refers to a third part of the empire. Now, the first trumpet, we read, consisted of hail and fire which was mingled with blood. And in brief, this refers to the Huns and the Goths, who afflicted the third part of the Roman Empire under Alaric, who ravaged Rome and its provinces. The trees, or the mighty men, and all the green grass, the Catholic multitude, were destroyed by these barbarians in the period AD 395 and onwards. Now, the second trumpet speaks of a great mountain which was cast into the sea. This refers to another one of the tribes, the Vandals. Under Genseric, who was called the Tyrant of the Sea, they destroyed the third part of the Roman fleet in the Mediterranean. We come to the third trumpet, AD 450. There fell a great star from heaven named Wormwood. This was called in the Greek Absinthos, a river in the Illyrian third of the Roman earth, from which came Attila of the Huns as the great star with his destructive armies. He devastated the western third of the Roman heavens, rendering the rivers and the waters symbolically bitter. And then finally, in AD 476, in the fourth trumpet, the third part of the sun, moon and stars were smitten. Romulus Augustus, the last emperor of the Western Empire, was banished by Odoacer of the Heruli, the first foreign prince who reigned in Italy under the title of patrician as the representative of the Eastern Roman Empire. Thus was the western third of the Roman heavens smitten and darkened. The Roman Empire in the west had fallen. Now, this number third, or a third, keeps coming up. You remember we mentioned that Constantine's empire was divided into three parts amongst his three sons? Now, this third refers to one of those three parts, because if you divide something up into three parts, you divide it up into thirds. The one third part which is referred to was the third part which involved the area of Rome. So if you want to see what this is about, I think it would be important to read our introductory note on page 91, which explains to us what these three divisions of the Roman Empire were and how the particular section which was to be judged was that section centering around Rome, where Catholicism had its focal point. So these four wind judgments, four wind trumpet judgments, are going now to bring to an end the Western Roman Empire. The other trumpets were going to deal with another aspect of Rome. So I think we might just as well read this note again on page 91. Hail and fire, referred to in verse 7 of Revelation chapter 8, the first trumpet, are symbolic of devastating judgment about to be poured out on Catholic Rome. Trees are symbolic of the great men among a people, and grass is figurative of the multitude. Before the blast of this trumpet is blown, the grass is green, but when the trumpet ceases to sound, it is burnt up and consequently black. Here again we could, if we wanted to, digress and look up the symbol tree and grass. But there's an exercise you can do. Trees are symbolical of great men, grass is symbolical of the multitude. Now, in connection with this expression, the third of the earth, it should be recalled that Constantine had divided his rule over the empire with his rivals, Licinius, who possessed the Illyrian prefecture, and Maximin, who possessed that composed of the Asiatic provinces and Egypt. The judgments of the trumpets were ordered with reference to this threefold division of the Catholic world. The first four trumpets were to be blown against the western third, that its inhabitants might be plagued until their power was broken and their sovereignty blotted out for a season. This western third consisted of Gaul or France, Spain, Britain, Italy, and the province of Africa. This was the third referred to in this verse because it comprised the seat of government. Hence the symbolism of this trumpet is representative of the Spirit of Yahweh blowing upon the great men and the people of the Catholic apostasy of the West. He did it by destroying agents already in a state of preparation represented by hail and fire. Now this map that we've got here doesn't show you those threefold divisions, but it mightn't be a bad idea if you were to sketch in roughly where you think those divisions were. So let's look at them. The third division, we were told, comprises France. I think you all can guess where France is. Spain, Britain, and Italy. So if you take a line following, say, that boundary of the Danube there and cut across to the top of Italy, and including that Britain and France and Spain, and then you cut across the Mediterranean and you take in the top part of Africa. That was the western section of the Roman Empire. That was one of the third parts. It involves the Mediterranean Sea, it involves North Africa, and it involves Rome, France, Spain, and Britain. Another third comprises the Asiatic provinces and Egypt. So if you go over to the area of Turkey and you go down through the Palestinian area and around into North Africa as far as wherever you put the border of the other part, so around through the top through Egypt there, I'd suggest you take a line down from about the 5 in 455 after the word Vandal, just above page 90. Somewhere around about there. That would be where that one meets up with the western section. So you've got in Turkey, all that area of Asia Minor, a bit further across than what our map goes and down into Egypt. That's the second third, if you like. Now the other third is that area of Illyricum. Well, we showed you where Illyricum was before. So this Illyrian third goes from wherever you put your boundary along the side of France there, across to, say, the Dardanelles, Hadrianapolis, and through there. So those are the three divisions, approximately, of the Roman Empire. Now, each one of these judgments of the wind trumpets is poured out on a third. The third has to be the ruling third, and it's going to be this western third, incorporating Italy, North Africa, Spain, France, Britain, that area. So each one of these judgments is now going to bring Catholic Rome down as far as its rulership in the West is concerned. And when that comes to an end, there's still Eastern Rome to deal with, but we don't worry about that just for the moment. The historical backgrounds here are particularly interesting, and I do hope you will read them through. I'm not going to read them through tonight, but they do make interesting reading. They are summarised about as briefly as I can imagine one could summarise something without starting to leave out relevant details. But read it up and see the way by which the Goths were prepared to come down and to judge pagan Rome. Catholic Rome, in the sense in which it is described here. If you come over now to the second trumpet, which is in verses 8 and 9, a different facet of the judgments are described. Because whereas the first trumpet was directed against the principal men, and against the grass. In other words, it was to be against the rulers and the people of the city of Rome in particular, and of the countryside thereabouts. And you can read in that historical section how Alaric came down and he sacked Rome. But when we come to this second trumpet, we find the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. And the third of the sea became blood, and the third of the creatures in the sea, having souls, died, and the third of the ships was destroyed. Now what have we got here? A mountain burning with fire. Now a mountain burning with fire is in direct contrast to mountains that bring peace to the people. You know, the future hope is that the mountains are going to bring peace to the people and the little hills by righteousness. But if you've got a mountain which is burning with fire, this is just the opposite. The power of Babel in the days of Jeremiah was described as a destroying mountain. So a mountain speaks of a political force. A mountain burning with fire is a political force which is going to come down in a judgmental sense. Waters. Well, I think we will all know that waters symbolise people in the terms of Revelation 17:15, and being a collection of waters, the sea becomes the symbol of people gathered together into one body politic, kingdom or jurisdiction. You might recall in Daniel chapter 7 that the great beasts were seen by the prophet to come out of the sea in consequence of the four winds striving upon the great sea, a symbol not unlike what we've got here. Now in this trumpet prophecy, the destroying power was to descend literally upon the maritime region washed by the waters of the Mediterranean and symbolically upon the peoples inhabiting these coasts. It proved to be true both literally and symbolically. The third of the sea refers to the same third part of the Roman Empire as that styled the third of the earth in verse 7. Just a different aspect of that particular part of the empire. And it was that region subject to the emperor of the Catholic West. It included the coasts of Spain, Gaul, Italy and Roman Africa, with the islands of Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica, Majorca and Menorca. This sea became blood as a result of its peoples being put to the sword at the hands of the Vandals. You can read in that rather interesting section on page 93 the way by which the Vandals did this. They crossed the sea from North Africa, and this was sea battle. These were sea battles. This was maritime warfare, which was going to bring Rome low. Because, you see, the Roman provinces which had been affected by the Goths in the area of Italy hadn't particularly been, well, the ones in North Africa hadn't been particularly affected by those same judgments. So it had to take to the sea now, and it was going to involve Africa as well. The creatures of the sea were the fish of this symbolic sea, and therefore fish in the symbolic sense. A sea being thus considered as a kingdom or empire, the living fishes in it must be typical of fishes or men. The introduction of ships into the prophecy indicates that the judgments of the second trumpet have a special regard to the naval and commercial interests of the western third's dominion. So in the four winds blowing, we're going to find that from four different angles the empire is to be judged. We come then to the third trumpet. This takes us to the period of AD 433, and we have the third angel sounding and a great star blazing as it were a torch falling out of heaven, and it fell upon the third of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. So here's Attila and the Huns. So the Goths poured out their judgment upon the trees and upon the grass. The Vandals poured out their judgment upon the sea. And now we've got Attila and the Huns pouring out their judgment upon the rivers and fountains of waters. The name of the star was called Absinthian, and the third of the waters became undrinkable, and many of the men died out of the waters because they were made bitter. Now once again we've got symbols here, and I am hopeful that you will, in your own time, follow a lot of these symbols through to consolidate the meaning that we're giving to them and to confirm the definition that we're placing upon them here in the notes. In the Apocalypse, sun, moon and stars are used as symbols of rulers. Jesus styles himself the bright and the morning star in Revelation 22:16. And Numbers 24:17 declares that there shall come forth a star out of Jacob that shall smite the princes of Moab and destroy all the children of Seth. A star, therefore, sometimes signifies a destroying power. What was seen in this case was not a fixed star, but a meteor. The falling of a blazing meteor is an appropriate symbol of a great destroying power progressing with rapid and intense but brief motion, and coming suddenly to the end of its career and leaving nothing but a smoking desolation as the memorial of its presence. The star was to fall upon a third of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. Now once again we have here a blending of both the literal and the symbolical. In the first judgment, you see, we had the area of Italy particularly devastated. In the second one, it takes in the sea and the area of North Africa. Now it's another area, both symbolically and literally represented here by fountains and rivers of waters. The rivers pertaining to the third represent symbolically its population and literally the geographical mountain, valley and river regions of the Catholic West. Brother Thomas states, these populations had not, previously to the shedding of the blood of the saints, and that had not, previously to the period of the third trumpet, done much in the way of shedding the blood of saints and prophets. They were beginning to approve of this remedy for what they styled heresy, but they had nevertheless shown themselves bitter persecutors of the sealed servants of God during the 125 years their rulers, who were all pious Catholics, exercised dominion over Italy, Gaul, Spain and Britain. The third trumpet was an especial element of the judgment upon them. Now the name of this star, which is called Absinthos or the Absinthian, indicates the region out of whose heaven this blazing star was to fall upon the third of the rivers, because Absinthos is the name of a river in the Illyrian third of the Roman Empire. This river was doubtless selected as an appropriate symbol because of the significance of the name being appropriate to the nature of the destruction executed by the new Illyrian power, which had been developed in the preparation of the angels of the trumpets for sounding. The word literally means undrinkable and is usually associated with the idea of bitterness. In the French language, the word absinthe is the term used for the bitter herb wormwood, as it has been translated in the Authorized Version. So if you're wondering where we're getting absinthos from, and the Authorized Version says wormwood, it's the same thing. The word wormwood is the word absinthos, and you can read that note through again and see how one makes the other. So here was the judgment coming out of the area of Illyricum, and it was now judging the areas of northern Italy in particular, coming around into Austria and so forth, where the rivers and the fountains of waters were to be judged. In reading the historical background of this period, when you come to read it, you'll see a quote in the second to last paragraph in which there is a typing error, which I think you ought to correct. Just taking the last sentence of the second to last paragraph in page 95 in that block there, we read, "The emperor was powerless to resist, and the city of Rome was only saved from destruction by the intervention, once again, of Pope Leo I, who visited Attila and is said to have, quote, subdued his ferocity into awe by the apostolic majesty of his men." The word isn't men, it's mean, M-I-E-N. A very modest fellow who said that as a result of my apostolic majesty and my manner or bearing, as the word M-I-E-N means. So he was just, his apostolic majesty and bearing was just so gracious that Attila of the Huns was absolutely awestruck by Pope Leo I. So that word men is really M-I-E-N, which alters the whole significance of what is being said there. And it means a manner or a bearing. Can you imagine Attila awestruck when you read the description of his fellows back in the third paragraph of this note, where it says, "History paints for us an incredible and a frightening picture of this wild nomadic people. They were more like fierce two-legged beasts than civilized men, illiterate, skinny, with dwarfish, foul-smelling bodies. Their faces were flat and their cheeks scarred from cuts made in childhood to stunt the growth of beards in later life. Under rat-skin helmets, their hair was filthy, black and bristly." And here goes Pope Leo, and by his very apostolic majesty and bearing, he impresses Attila and he tells him that, you know, not to carry on with the conquest. Anyway, read that through. It does make very interesting reading, as I said before, and fill in the extra details from Eureka as well. Well, time is fast running away with us, but I think we've got sufficient time to just comment now on the fourth of these trumpets, and from our note on page 96. The fourth angel sounded, and the third of the sun and the moon and the stars were smitten. So up till now we've done the trees and the grass, we've done the waters and the seas, and then we've done the rivers, and now it's the sun and the moon and the stars. That means the whole system is now going to collapse. The events of the first three trumpets had reduced the power of Rome to nothing more than the semblance of an empire, but with none of the vigour that had for centuries controlled the world. There was still an emperor in Rome, but the barbarians, whom the first three trumpets had called into the empire, were the virtual masters of the state, and soon became its nominal and actual masters. It has been seen previously that the symbols used are representative of the ruling powers, and the third, as before, was the Western Catholic third of the Roman Empire. Before the narrative passes on to the sounding of the fifth trumpet, an eagle, not an angel as the authorized version says, an eagle flying through the midst of the heaven proclaims, "Woe, woe, woe to the dwellers upon the earth." The eagle is representative of the community of the saints, and the message which was declared was that the calamities endured at the hands of the barbarian leaders were not complete. The eagle is depicted as a bird which searches for and destroys the flesh. And so here we've got then, as the four wind trumpets come to an end, the western section of the Roman Empire being reduced to complete subjection to these Roman hordes, but the Spirit declaring the judgments are not yet complete, because there are three woes to be poured out, and there is still the eastern section of the Roman Empire which has been basically untouched as far as these judgments are concerned. Well, for those who don't like history, I hope you found that a little bit interesting, because it does actually bring into perspective God's view of history. So if you just go back and open up this little fold-out chart between pages 88 and 89, see what God is telling us here about a period of 150 years approximately of world history. You can read all sorts of history books, and they might enlarge some points and reduce others. But as far as God is concerned, this is what happened. Constantine established Christianity as the state religion. That was the end of paganism and the ushering in of a new era known as the Catholic era. Right, we are now looking at what God's going to do with the Catholic era. First of all, there is silence for half an hour. That's during the reign of Constantine. Comparative peace. As soon as he goes, his three sons, who are taking over these three third parts of the Roman Empire, fight amongst themselves. They all get wiped out, and that leaves Julian, the apostate, who causes an earthquake by trying to restore paganism. He upsets the things a little bit, but he is soon replaced, and Jovian comes on the scene and restores Catholic Rome in its full glory. But Jovian makes a fatal mistake, because he allows the Goths to come over and to settle on the southern side of the river Danube, thinking they would be quite harmless. And so the angels prepare to sound. Once the Goths are there, God can now allow those four winds, which were being restrained back in chapter 7, to now come and blow from the four directions. First of all upon the trees and the grass, then upon the seas, then upon the rivers and fountains of waters, and finally that the sun and the moon and the stars might be completely eclipsed. Catholic Rome then, as ruled from the west, was to be destroyed, and the year AD 476 is generally regarded as the end of the western section of the Roman Empire. Now, what have you got to do about all this? Well, I think it's imperative that you do get Eureka out and you read the historical facts. Being realistic, there are some, and this is only a few, I'm not making an allowance for the majority here, there are a few who may find Eureka too much. So get out the 13 lectures. That's the minimum requirement. 13 lectures on the apocalypse by Robert Roberts, and read what he has to say about it. But preferably, read the section in Eureka. Now, I'm not just saying please do it. You've got to do this. Otherwise, the studies are going to be meaningless from here on if you don't sort of pick out all the details. So you've got to do that. and you've got to bring yourself up to date then with these historical facts. Not only that, but that you've then also got to prepare yourself for the next section, where we're going to cover a very big period of history, because the woe trumpets cover the rise of Mohammedism, which covers quite a few verses in the Bible and quite a few pages in our notes, and then gets on to the rise of the Turkish Empire, which takes us right through to beyond the year 1000. Probably a period that most people don't know very much about as far as history is concerned. So if you're going to enjoy the classes, it's imperative that you do some background reading. Now, on top of that, because that's not all that much to do, you've also got to check up on some of these symbols, such as trees and rivers and sun and moon and stars. Now, I'm not joking, I'm of course quite serious about this. I think some of you may think I'm joking, but I'm not really. You've got to therefore do that, and then you're coming along to the next class having done all that, and on top of that, you're going to bring your notepaper and your pens along, for those who didn't do it this time, and you're going to take notes down. Now, it's very important. We can't just come here and sit through a class and look at the speaker, sometimes with our eyes open and sometimes with our eyes closed, and expect to go away knowing all about Revelation. Now, there are some that are doing this. Let's be quite frank and honest about it. If you're going to get something out of Revelation, you've got to put as much time into the study as I've had to put into it. And I've had to put many hundreds of hours over the last 2 years into this, and if you're going to benefit from it, you've got to do this work. So I'm saying it very nicely, but quite dogmatically, I'm very serious, brethren and sisters. If we're going to study Revelation, we can't afford to get behind. And we can't hope to get anything out of it unless we put a lot of work into it. There is a blessing pronounced upon those who read, those who hear, and those who keep the things that are written in this book. We cannot read, hear, and keep this by just coasting, by just putting a half-hearted effort, or by making a nominal attendance at the class. So, you know where you stand in regard to this individually. I'm just making a general broad statement because I know there's all sorts of attitudes here. You know, some will be doing all this, as I've already said, and others perhaps have never thought about doing it before. So may we suggest that for your benefit and for your brethren and sisters' benefit, that the preparation for the next class is important, and it's going to involve some historical reading. There is enjoyment to be gained from these things. There is an immediate blessing to be gained by our understanding of the apocalypse, because it transmits our minds into the future and we live as though it were in the kingdom. But the greater blessing, and a blessing we trust which is very soon to dawn, will be the blessing of associating with those people who are the actors in this drama as depicted in the book of Revelation, and that we might be with them in that day of the Lamb's glory.
After we have sung together hymn 192. Hymn 192.